Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, February the 13th, 2023. The time is 3:30 p.m. Please silence all cell phones. Members present today are Senator Klayman, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator Bishop, Senator Diesel, and Senator Dunbar, and Senator Kaufman, who's going to be presenting. Senator Kawasaki is momentarily away on other state business, but will be joining us in a bit. So, on comms today, we have Carrie Cooperwriter, Amanda Kraft, and Nick West, and they have some on-the-job training going back here today, so that's good. Our first hearing is today is a renewable energy grant fund by Senator Kaufman. Then we're going to have a department overview from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation on 404 primacy. So, first up, Senate Bill 33, Renewable Energy Grant Fund. And our intention is to hear this bill and set it aside. So, Senator Kaufman, if you and Ms. Torgelson would join us at the table, we'd appreciate it. And Ms. Torgelson will then give us the sectional after we're done grilling the senator on this big bill.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bishop, members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, James Kaufman, Senate District F. Sponsor statement has already been shared, and I'm sure all of you have had a chance to look at it. It's fairly brief, but I thought I'd just go over a couple of bullet points of what the bill is and what it does, how it works, etc. So SB 33 extends the sunset date of the Renewable Energy Grant Fund and Recommendation Program, setting a new sunset set date for June 30th, 2023. The history of the program is that the Renewable Energy Fund, or REF, was originally established in 2008. The REF is managed by the Alaska Energy Authority in coordination with a 9-member Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee. Since its inception, the Renewable Energy Fund has distributed over $300 million in grant funds for front-end feasibility and early design development of qualifying competitively selected renewable energy projects across the state. Approximately $39 million has been directed at projects on the Road Belt and $259 million to projects in rural Alaska targeted at reducing energy costs in those committees. So how it works, the REF program accepts applications in rounds. Each submission is considered on several factors, with the most weight given to projects that serve residents who experience higher than average energy costs. One of the documents in your bill packet gives a complete list and an explanation of the criteria and weighting. The AEA submits the recommendations to the advisory committee, and their final recommendations are then sent to the legislature for approval and funding. 31 applications were received in round 15, which closed in December. AEA and the advisory committee will submit their recommendations to the legislature by March of this year. Why this bill is important. Most REF grants have been matched by both federal and local funding to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. These combined funds help stabilize and reduce energy costs for consumers by supporting renewable energy projects in communities across Alaska. As energy prices climb, it's important for Alaska to take advantage of all sources of energy and all of the above program, especially our most energy vulnerable communities. The Renewable Energy Grant Fund is an important tool which supports Alaskan communities, alleviate the high costs of fuel, and meet their energy needs. So with that, thank you all. And my staff member, Emma Torkelson, is here to go through the sectional and provide any additional details. And I believe we also have Executive Director Curtis Thayer from the AEA on the line as well, or we have planned to.
Do we have questions from committee members before we pass it off to Ms. Torkelson for a sectional? When Senator Klayman.
Sometimes we get legislative audit doing an audit of a program when we renew. It doesn't look like there's one this year for this. Am I correct?
There'll be one at Senate Finance.
There is. Okay. Thank you for that answer. Saved him from having to answer.
So if no further questions, I'll hand off to the most capable Ms. Torkelson.
Ms. Torkelson? Thank you, Co-Chair Bishop and members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, Emma Torkelson, staff to Senator Kaufman. Section 1 amends Section 5, Chapter 31, the SLA 2008, as previously amended, to extend the repeal date of the Renewable Energy Grant Fund to June 30th, 2033. Section 2 adds contingency language, making the sunset extension retroactive to June 30th, 2023, if the bill takes effect after the fund sunsets. And Section 3 gives the bill an immediate effective date. Thank you.
I don't see any questions from committee members. With that, we're going to thank you for the presentation. We're going to open invited testimony. We're going to go to Mr. Curtis Thayer, the Executive Director of Alaska Energy Authority. Mr. Thayer?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Curtis Thayer. I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And just a little, I appreciate the overview of the program. There's been over $300 million appropriated by the legislature, primarily from UGF since the inception of 2008 for the program. We currently have 90 programs in development with 44 new ones just in the last 2 years, which is funding provided by the legislature, $4.7 million and $15 million. And we have used in the past the number of 30 million gallons of diesel has been displaced with this program. And we are currently doing a review of that with an independent economist to determine that number, and we'll share that with the legislature. But this is funded $300 million into rural Alaska. 85% of the money goes into rural Alaska. 15% has primarily been on the rail belt or in urban Alaska. There's nothing set in statute or regulations by that, but that's generally how it falls out, is about 85%. And just in the last two rounds, some interesting, I think, statistics is primarily we're looking at wind and solar and hydro across the various entities. Primarily the biggest one being wind is the one of most interest. And the other thing that's of telling of the program is a lot of the work here, I think the shining example is in Prince of Wales Island. You have Halungnai, which started out as a REF program, which is now a full-fledged operating a hydro project, which is now makes Prince of Wales over 90% renewable. And we have those successes across the state. But this really is the feasibility stage to get these projects kicked off and determine are these viable projects. And then from there, they either get independent funding, state funding, or federal funding to take it to the next level. And with that, the most current round that we did, round 15, which we owe the legislature in March, currently there are 33 applicants for $31 million is the request. Now, of course, we do an economic analysis of feasibility of those projects and get that number narrowed down to actually see what we have plus the funding that's available. But this has been a very successful program, and extending this is another 10 years. I think it would be great. We did try to move this bill last year. It got slowed down in the Senate Finance, the clock ran out of time, but there was no opposition last year at this bill. But I'm wide open for any questions. And I also have Connor Erickson, who is our planning manager, who is actually the project manager for the REF program.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Thayer, for being online. I did have a question. You mentioned that 85% are in rural areas, and then that 15% are within the road belt, but that there's not a specific criteria laid out in statute. Can you just sort of run me through the evaluation processes and the different stages which would make that happen, that more rural and remote projects qualify?
Through the chair, I'd like to have Connor Erickson, our planning manager, who's responsible for the program, and he's done the last three rounds, and he might have a...
Yeah, so this is Connor Erickson with Alaska Energy Authority Planning Manager. Senator Kostecki, I was just... it's a four-step evaluation process. So we initiate through the submission of a request for applications. The timing of which has somewhat changed in the last couple of years just due to, but generally it goes out in the fall time frame. And then it's out on the street for about 60 days or so, 45 to 60 days. And then we get the applications that come in. The first stage is kind of an eligibility review with respect to both applicant eligibility and project eligibility. The second stage is kind of a more thorough view of, you know, looking at the economic, financial, and technical feasibility of these applications. And then the third stage is ranking these applications based on the scoring as part of the stage two process, but then also looking at, you know, how much matching funds are being contributed as well as some other criteria. And then the fourth is then, you know, kind of what is weighting these projects based on where they're at, because we have a historical look at how many, you know, based on the various energy regions, how much money has been appropriated to each energy region over the past, you know, all rounds. And so we try to, because in statute, we're required to look at the balancing of these funds. But, you know, to a point, we in some instances, you know, we've just been fortunate to have been able to fund all projects that have come in, and that's happened for the last two rounds. You know, it's really kind of subject to the amount of funding available or how much the legislature is looking to afford the program.
So follow-up.
Follow-up?
Yeah. So thanks, Connor. I didn't catch your last name. But the question, I guess, then on the – so if there's an evaluative process, but the process looks like it's technically and economically feasible in stage two – I guess I'm just trying to pinpoint where exactly or why exactly it seems that the rural areas or remote areas seem to score much higher. Is it just simply because of the stage three project ranking, where the cost of energy is so much higher in one place than it is the other, or is it something else?
Yeah. Through the chair, this is Connor Erickson again with AEA. Responding to your question, so it's really based on purely who it is that applies in any given round. I mean, there's nothing requiring anyone to apply to the program, and it just so happens that, you know, for the last couple rounds, there's been, you know, many more applicants from rural areas, 200 plus applicants from rural areas versus the rail belt. But also that you are correct. There is a cost of energy score that's attributed to each application if it passes stage two. And the higher the cost of energy in a particular area, the more points it would score in that ranking.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions, Senator Geisel?
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on Senator Kawasaki's questions, in our packet of information, we have Renewable Energy Fund Evaluation Process Overview. It's dated January 12, 2023, and for the public who's listening, may not have followed all those points, it's actually written out what the statutory guidance is in the various stages. So, again, for the public listening who might want more details, this is probably posted online with today's meeting. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you for that. Any further questions, comments? Seeing none, invited testimony is closed.
Your line is muted.
All right, good. So.
Your line is unmuted.
All right. Anything else you want to say before we set this bill aside?
Thank you. Through the chair, to the committee, I just want to say thanks for the questions and also for the clarification of the process that's in the materials. So I appreciate the bill being heard. Thank you very much.
All right. We're going to set an amendment deadline, pretty aggressive one. That's tomorrow at 4 p.m. So brief at ease while we change presenters. Good to go. Commissioner Bruni, welcome. And Meg Kohler, you're the Admin Services Director, is that right?
Yeah, for the record, Megan Kohler, Administrative Services Director for the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Okay, Commissioner, put yourself on the record and the floor is yours. And I'll look to the committee for questions as we go along.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bishop, Co-Chair Giesel, members of the Resources Committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Jason Bruni, and I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Before we get into the discussion of the 404 assumption effort, I was asked to give an overview of the department, so we can go into as much detail as you want about the department or as little, but we do have a presentation, so I will start with that. First, obviously, DEC's mission on the screen, long and the short of it, is protecting human health and the environment. We have five values that we put in place when I became commissioner 4 years ago. Obviously, keen focus on everything we do, focusing on customer service, combined with collaboration, integrity, accountability, and objectivity. The five divisions that we have, obviously, Meg oversees the administrative services, and then we have the four main areas, obviously, when you think of environmental protection and human health. You have water quality, air quality, spill prevention and response, and environmental health. We established metrics when I got into this position, and it's important, obviously, because we're accountable to you, and you are our funders. We work for you. We do no more and no less than what you tell us to do, so we want to make sure we're reporting to you what it is we're doing. So putting forward permits and approvals and certifications and plan reviews, this past year we had around 11,000 in 2021, and then this 2022 we had around 10,000. There wasn't any major differences. Just some of the permits are every other year, and so it's a consistent. It's no indication of how the economy is working. It's just that that was the number that we processed in 2022. With COVID going hopefully the way of the dodo bird, we were able to get out and inspect, do more in-person inspections. Obviously, when we put stipulations or other requirements and permits, it's important that we go and we make sure that those are being adhered to. So this past year, we had 3,500 inspections. The previous year, obviously, with COVID, we were putting a lot of emphasis on doing virtual inspections. I really want to continue to do that because you can do a lot with a FaceTime and going and someone that's in Dutch Harbor maybe that wants to have some compliance assistance or we want to do an inspection. To be able to do that, that saves time, that saves money, and plus it brings the relationship between the regulated community and DEC closer, allows us to have more access to each other. So we did put a huge emphasis on virtual inspections during the pandemic. Of course, in-person inspections are very important as well. One of the things also, as we've continued to put an emphasis on telework with DEC employees, I'd say about 75% of our employees spend 2 to 3 days of their work week working remotely. You need to have access to the files. So we've really put an emphasis on scanning all of our files and getting them accessible to all of our employees. Of course, I think many of you have heard me say, I think many of you were here. When I got here, there was around a 25 to 30% annual turnover rate at DEC. When you're trying to do timely, science-based, legally defensible permits and you're losing 3 out of 10 people on an annual basis, that's horrible. We've put in training programs. We've made sure that every single employee at DEC has a development plan. What do they want to do in 1, 3, 5 years? What training can we give them so that they can develop into that? You know, if they want to become the next commissioner or they just want to become the next supervisor, whatever it is, how can we make them better? How can we see that they have a career path? So important to me. And so we really track the number of hours, training hours that each employee is being given. And we're averaging 50 hours per week for some employee or for all of DEC. In SPAR, we're nearly 2.5 weeks of training on an annual basis. And that's brought the retention levels of SPAR to record levels. And again, we're at 14% annual turnover rate now. Again, it's not great still, but when it was 30% 4 years ago and it's 14% now during the year of the Great Resignation, I'm really proud of that. I'm really proud of the fact that we're making career opportunities for the folks at DEC and they're staying. Our department.
Senator Klayman.
If you go back to when you started work in the department, how many positions did the department have? How many of those were filled? And today, how many positions are in the department and how many of those are filled?
So we were around 475 employees. Through the chair, Senator Klayman, we were around 470 positions, I believe, when I started. With the EJA funding and the additional positions that we've added, we're around 516 today. We put a keen emphasis on making sure those positions are full, Senator Klayman. I do not like if we have a position and it's vacant more than 6 months, it's flagged. And I'm like, it shows you don't need it. So it's been a keen emphasis to make sure if we have a position, it's going to be filled or it's going to be targeted for elimination, Senator. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Can I see another hand over here? No, I just want to make a comment on your training model here you've been telling us about. Have you shared that with any of your other commissioners that's having some high percentage issues of retaining employees?
Co-Chair Bishop, thank you for that question. Of course, we talk about the need for training at our cabinet meetings. It's the retention levels at the state are something we should absolutely be working to try to improve. And I think the things we've put in place, emphasis on training and emphasis on career opportunities as well as opportunities for telework, is something we definitely talk about at the cabinet level on a regular basis.
One last follow-up from myself before we move along. So we see your inspections, and you used your iPhone, you know, during the COVID experiences. Do you have a voluntary inspection program, meaning I call DEC and I think this is what I want to do. Can you come out and give me a once-over, a voluntary inspection where if you see something, it's just like OSHA, right? You can go down here to OSHA, have a voluntary inspection. The only time they'll cite you is if there's immediately dangerous to life and health issue, right? Anything else, they just give you a red, yellow card, and it's no foul until you get a time to correct it. Do you have anything like that at DEC?
Chair Bishop, thank you for the reference to soccer as well. I love the yellow card, red card reference. I think that compliance assistance and partnering with the regulated community is absolutely vital and something we put a keen emphasis on at DEC. You want to be the partner that the regulated community calls rather than the entity that they're afraid of. You want to be working collaboratively to help their projects, their community development projects, their resource development projects advance in a way that protects human health and the environment, but also allows them to move forward. So absolutely, when we get those calls, Senator Bishop, we jump at the opportunity to try to work collaboratively with them. It's not about a gotcha, we're giving you a notice of violation. It's about how can we help you do what you want to do to protect human health and the environment and have your project go forward. So absolutely, that's a keen emphasis of ours.
Thank you. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have a question about the vacancy rates, and I know that you do have a slide in later on in the presentation. But you mentioned that there's 3 out of 10 people that you're losing within a certain time frame. This is just a snapshot, I think. The vacancy rate looks like just under or just over 6%. So I'm just trying to understand the 3 out of 10 people. So during any particular year, what's the changeover, I guess, is the question.
Yeah. Thanks, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. I apologize that the way I articulated that was obviously wrong. When I got into this role, Senator Kawasaki, 4 years ago, the turnover rate was roughly 30%, 25 to 30%. Currently, it's 14%. But we've cut the turnover rate in half. But a vacancy rate is what percentage of the year is that position actually not filled? So if you have a position that turns over 4 times in 1 year, but you filled it like immediately after the person leaves, you could have a 0% vacancy rate, but a very large turnover rate. Does that make sense? So the number you're seeing on the vacancy rate is what is the percentage of time that all of the 516 positions that we have at DEC are left unfilled, and that's a budgetary number.
Follow up. Yeah, I guess it's just for me to understand, because we are going to talk about permits in the next presentation, and how are there enough people currently to monitor those permits that have the experience to do so? I think we'll come up with it pretty soon, and so I wanted to just ask a little bit more about that. And then do you know, as far as these inspections and site visits and permit approvals, what the backlog is currently for the agency at this point in air quality and water quality?
Yeah, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, first of all, to your first point, absolutely. That's one of the reasons why we have such a keen emphasis on improving our retention. And we've done a great job. We've improved it by over 50%. And so having that kind of expertise built up within DEC has been one of my absolutely strong tenets to running the organization. And we've made huge strides. So I you and I are completely aligned on that one. And then, the second question?
The second question through the chair had to do with the permit approvals and if we've always had backlogs both DNR and in DEC. Just in order for us to do business and for businesses to do business, we want to make sure that those permits are done in an accurate time and in a time frame that folks recognize and understand.
Yeah, Senator Kawasaki through the chair. With respect to backlogs, I'm definitely going to get back to you on that, but that's not something that's been an issue within DEC that I've been here. Yes, there is a time frame that permits take to get processed, but there are some issues with respect to air quality. There's going to be three major statewide implementation plans that are going to be coming forward. One of them, obviously, you're very aware of with the SIP that the EPA just rejected in Fairbanks. We have a regional haze and a NAAQS SIP. But those aren't permits necessarily that are coming from industry. We have had some requests for some expedited and additional staff that we've heard from folks, and we're putting those requests in for air quality folks. But for the most part, we don't have a backlog at DEC.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That information, you can just forward it to our office and we'll distribute it to the committee members.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Please continue.
Real quickly, I want to talk about the expertise that we have at DEC. We have nearly 100 years of state service working for the department. I'm really proud of that. We'll start, obviously, with our Deputy Commissioner, Emma Pocon. Emma has been with the state, was formerly with the Department of Law. She worked up on the North Slope Borough and lived in Uktiavik. She is a wealth of knowledge and is fantastic to have in the department. Crystal Kieneman, obviously, is our legislative liaison. She has nearly 20 years here in the building, and she's just been a great addition to my team. And then my five directors, Meg Kohler has been with DEC for nearly 10 years, worked for SPAR prior to becoming the ASD. Christina Carpenter was our AOM, then became our environmental health director. She's been with the department nearly 10 years. Jason Olds used to be our head of enforcement for the Division of Air. We had a huge loss this past year. Alice Edwards had been with the department for 30-plus years, was an amazing wealth of knowledge, former deputy commissioner, obviously air director, and she got to retire. Very happy for her, but Jason Olds was the enforcement director and matriculated up. Tiffany Larson, been at DEC for nearly 20 years, worked in the air division, worked in the water division as enforcement, and was a great opportunity to put her as the SPAR director. And of course, Randy Bates, who's here in the room. Randy has been the head of OPUMP, the head of Habitat with Fish and Game, been at DNR, ADF&G, and now is running possibly the most controversial division in the state with all the work he gets to do. So he's been with the state for nearly a quarter century. So what a great leadership team. And then combined with that, we have Julie Pack. Julie is a we kind of have a test case that we're doing with having an embedded AAG within a department. And so Julie is actually within the Department of Environmental Conservation. She is a still works for the Department of Law, but is at our office 24/7. And it's a great having that kind of expertise embedded within in the department. And she'll be presenting in a little bit. So that's the overview from a budget perspective. Meg's going to talk a little bit about the specific divisions, Mr. Chair.
Again, for the record, Megan Kohler, Administrative Services Director with Environmental Conservation. From this perspective, we went ahead and took a highlight look, so not necessarily in the details of the budget. I'll call out those as we move through this, but I recognize that there's a topic following us, and so being respectful of your time. For this, obviously the highlights are the hazardous waste program that we assumed primacy, or we took that program on last year, and we've got those positions hired and are moving forward with that, as well as a microreactor siting permit that Christina Carpenter's team is working on as we move through. That'll be in the Eielson area, as well as food security. And then the EJIA-funded projects, obviously, we're seeing a large influx of federal dollars, and we do have some program receipts requested in this budget as well. And then our environmental health laboratory is continuing to also see that forward progress in those federal dollars.
Could you repeat where you're going to potentially cite this permit for the nuclear plant, SMR?
Yes, that'll be the Eielson.
And what was your time frame for getting that permit executed?
For the record, Jason Bruni, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. So we are putting a regulatory package out there right now. The Air Force came to us and said they want to let that contract in July. So we went out with a scoping process. I wanted to make sure we were hearing the concerns of the public. That scoping process occurred December and January. The regulatory package is going to be coming out within the next month. There will be another opportunity for the public to provide comment, and our hope is that those regulations for where these facilities can be sited, and this is statewide. In this instance, obviously, it's with respect to Eielson, Mr. Chair, but there will be other opportunities for displacing diesel in rural Alaska, maybe bringing resource development projects on using these microreactors with the legislation that the legislature passed last year. The hope is to have that regulatory package completed by this July.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So two questions. First, we had a quite detailed presentation on the microreactors here, and it seemed like the technology was still quite a ways away from commercial viability. So I appreciate us getting the regulatory package together, but it also strikes me that the sort of Eielson with all their DOD resources is very different than some of these very small rural communities where they might go. So I'm not sure what the question is there exactly, but it's just, it seemed like it was pretty far out. The second is, could you just speak a little bit more, Deputy Director, about the Environmental Health Laboratory? This is new to me, and I'm not familiar with it. I'd just like to hear a little bit more if that's okay with the Chair.
Senator Dunbar, through the Chair, first, the nuclear regulator, basically, I think many of you have heard me say, I can do no more and no less than what the legislature instructs me to do. And that bill that was passed this past year instructed us to put a siting regulatory package forward. We agree completely with you, which is why we're spreading the word far and wide. We're having a meeting tomorrow with the tribal interests and the Alaska Native Corporation, regional and village corporations, to ensure that the tribes are and the indigenous people are aware of the siting. And we want to make sure that what we're putting in place, not just for Eielson, but for statewide, if this is going to be something that's in place, is well-informed, that we're transparent, that we're hearing from the concerns of the local people that could be impacted by this. And if there ever is a desire to reopen that up, we can always do that as well. With respect to the Environmental Health Lab, through the Chair, Senator Dunbar, it's a great facility. It's the one building that DEC owns, and there we'd love to invite you to come on a tour. We do all sorts of testing for, obviously, human health, for mariculture. We have a mouse colony that we maintain. That's the best way, obviously, to check to see for paralytic shellfish poison. We do milk dairy testing. We do all sorts of other testing. Of course, our environmental health lab oversees our drinking water program as well. So a lot of great stuff over there. It's right over there on Martin Luther King. And anytime you're interested, we'd love to give you a tour.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Klayman.
Going back to the RCRA C program, how many positions were authorized for that? And yeah, that's the first question.
Senator Klayman, through the Chair, the legislature approved 6 positions for that this past year.
Follow up. And for the RCRA program, what's the funding source for that? Are there federal funds involved? And if there are federal funds, what's the breakdown from the state and federal?
Senator Klayman, through the Chair, for the assumption process for RCRA, it's 100% funded by a general fund. But once we receive primacy for that program, there will be approximately $600,000 that comes in from the federal government for our oversight of it.
Follow up. Is that annual $600,000? And if that is, how much of the program does that pay for?
Senator Klayman, through the Chair, it is annual, and I believe it's about 50 to 60% of the program will be paid for by federal receipts.
And follow up going back, what's your timeline to getting the RCRA program approved? Because it sounds like you're right now just in the application process.
Yeah, Senator Klayman, through the Chair, the whole process was roughly a 2-year process. We're developing the application right now. We will submit it this January, a year from now approximately. The EPA at that point, Senator Klayman, will have 5 months or so. I don't know the exact timeline, but the plan is effective July 1st, 2024, we will have the program approved by the EPA and we will be overseeing it. So a 2-year
total implementation time.
So you'll finish the application within the next 6 months and then roughly 6 months for the EPA to either approve or not approve?
Senator Clayman, 10 months probably through the chair, because we're in February right now, and the goal is to have that application submitted to the EPA by January of next year. So
2024,
yes, sir. And then they'll have roughly 6 months to take action on that application. So roughly 17 months remaining.
So more likely 2025 by the time the DEC would be running the program?
So the through the chair, Senator Clayman, fiscal year 25, but July 1st of 2024, we will have the program. That was what our plan was.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got a couple questions on the slide. Just the first one relating to the micrositing permits. So we know how long the bill passed, I think it was probably late March or something like that. So we get regulations, say, in March now. And then isn't there like a 90-day public opening? And then I'm just trying to figure out the timeline if we do plan to have permits in place for Eielson by that point in time. Can you run me through that?
Yeah. Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, it's a great question. And it was very frustrating when the Air Force let me know that they were planning on letting that contract in July. When that happened, I said, listen, we can't force through regulations like this without having meaningful public dialogue. So that's why I, Senator Kawasaki, mandated that we had a scoping process. We received about 100 comments from the public with concerns and issues that we need to address. We're using those comments, obviously, to help develop the regulatory package that will be out in the next couple of weeks. You're right. I think it's going to be a 60-day comment period. It may be 90. It's 60 or 90-day, but for sure we wanted to make sure there was adequate timing. We're only required, Senator Kawasaki, to give a 30-day comment period, but I know this is, again, controversial. Based on the comments that are received, we're going to have to respond to all of those comments. The hope, obviously, is to get it through the process so that it doesn't go stale. You have to do that within a year, so of when you start. Our hope, though, is that we can get it done and respond to it, get it to the lieutenant governor for signing off on sometime in the July timeframe, assuming the Department of Law oversees it. But it could take we would have up to 6 months additionally, given the time frame before it goes stale.
So follow up on the thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on the permit won't be released from DEC until sometime after July. Is that then what I'm hearing? So there's a point in time in which you look at the review from, I guess, the Army Corps of Engineers or whoever it's from, and agree that it follows the regulation. Is that what the process is?
Yeah, so Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, we're going to have to put these regulations in place, and then the entity will have to apply through the process. And if you remember, Senator Kawasaki, the legislature put in there that it also needs the – I don't remember the exact language – but the local community of government jurisdiction to also sign off on it. So there's going to be a process. This is just putting the regulations in place that then the applicant will have to follow.
Okay, not related. I just have one brief question.
Please, I just want everybody to know it's 408, and we got seven more pages to go in this presentation, and then we got the main attraction coming. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. The IJA-funded projects, there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them that are circumventing, maybe not circumventing is the wrong word, but just going from tribal entities, other places, municipal organizations, things like that. So there probably are anticipated more reviews that the department will handle. And just sort of getting back to the question that I had regarding reviews and how long those take and whether the permits are the backlog. You're not anticipating that there's going to be a backlog for those potential large public projects, right?
Yeah. Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, 32 communities in Alaska are unserved. They still are on honey buckets. This is a priority of ours. It's a priority of Governor Dunleavy. It's a priority of our congressional delegation. We added positions from the EJA funding that are going to help us be able to meet those timelines. We also, obviously, many of those projects will have impacts on wetlands. So that's also another of the reason that we're looking at this assumption of the 404 program. we don't see those 32 communities being immediately upgraded. Yeah, they have the funding for it, but we don't have the capability within the state to upgrade 32 communities all at once. So the EPA has told us they're going to give us 10 to 15 years to be able to do that. So we assume that there will be additional time. All of us have the goal of getting these communities off of honey buckets, and we're going to make sure we do everything in our power to have to help them make that happen.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Okay, please continue.
Thank you. For air quality, this is we have a couple of items that are within our capital budget. One is the Fairbanks State implementation plan. As that is associated, you'll see that is one of our capital asks. We have three concurrent state implementation plans coming through to us. So there has been an additional ask for eight positions, as well as an increase in funding for the contractual services. As the commissioner mentioned, we had a pretty large loss of institutional knowledge. And so we're looking, right now we're able to do one state implementation plan, and we have a lot of stuff coming down the pipe for us. Moving on to spill prevention and response. Obviously, some of these items have made the news recently and are hot topics. One is the PFAS contaminated sites and continuing to respond to those, as well as the ANCSA litigation, which I'm sure the commissioner would talk to, as well as the PFAS regulatory package.
And Mr. Chair, for the record, Jason Bruni, DC Commissioner. This is one of the things I'm really excited about. Obviously, a number of you were expressed concerns during my confirmation process about the PFAS regulatory package. I am excited to announce that we have blessing from the administration to go forward with a regulatory package to set limits for PFAS in the state. I announced that at the Alaska Forum on the Environment this past week. Senator Keel in his floor speech last week and I have been talking lengthily over the years about this issue, and so we're really excited actually to be able to set those limits, and we'll be beginning that regulatory package within the next couple of months. In addition, I think you all have heard me talk about just the travesty that is the federal administration that refuses to follow their own lead in cleaning up the contamination that they've left on Alaska Native Corporation lands. We ultimately had to bring a lawsuit against them. We'll be talking more about that later this week in statehood defense when we present to this committee. But it's been one of my priorities to make sure that they follow through with their promise to the indigenous people of this state.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So growing up in Cordova, this is a sort of passion of mine, and as everyone is there, and issues of cost recovery and serves and the like. It was raised to me recently by a Prince William Sound organization that, so we have a fund that's established using, you can correct me on the exact numbers, I think it's 0.9 cents of every gallon, and then 4 cents per barrel at Alyeska, I think that's the numbers, but correct me if I'm mistaken, it would be 5 cents. But there's concerns that that will no longer, that's not sufficient to run the number of programs, and the fund is now sort of expanded beyond just, you know, traditional oil spill preparation and response in Prince William Sound. It's now dealing with every statewide, right? Every time there's a small spill, it helps fund that. So my question is, first of all, is that all correct in your mind? And second, there's a proposal to perhaps increase the 0.9 cents to 1.5 cents. Is that something your division supports, and sort of why or why not?
Yeah, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, thanks so much for those questions. And I, too, spent a lot of time in Cordova as a young biologist. I worked on oil sea otters, and I've been on the Public Advisory Committee for the Exxon Valdez Oil Trustee Council for years, and now I'm a trustee. So it's actually a pretty cool opportunity that I have in this role. You're close. SPAR is funded by 4 cents to the prevention account for every barrel of oil produced in the state, not just that goes through TAPS, but in Cook Inlet as well. And 1 cent goes to what's called the response account. So 4 plus 1, that 1 cent gets cut off if and when the response fund hits $50 million. It's not close to hitting $50 million. It's in the $30 million range right now. So it's 5 cents per barrel of production. About 8 years ago, they put something in for the 470 fund to diversify the funding so that it's 0.95 cents per barrel refined fuel surcharge. And there was a number of exemptions that were put in place for that. And a couple of years ago, the surplus, when I got into this role, I was told in 4 years that money would be run out and it's not sustainable. We would have to eliminate positions. I am a planner. I could have just put my head in the sand and I could have said, that's someone else's problem. It's not how I did it. I got a lot of grief for this, but I recommended that we do a twofold approach. Number one, we had to cut some positions. We cut 14 positions from SPAR, 7 each year. And at the same time, we had to diversify our funding. It was not popular. It was not something I wanted to do, especially given my history, but many of those positions were also unfilled. So you can't go asking for more positions if you're not filling the current positions that you have. That having been said, we have settled at a number of 120 positions within SPAR. I've told my SPAR director if she ever needs new employees, I will go to bat and I will advocate for them in a heartbeat. Right now, they have very good retention, and she says we don't need additional positions. So we're very focused on that. But final answer to your other question is, absolutely, the administration has been on the record multiple times supporting the diversification of funding and increasing that refined fuel surcharge from 0.95 cents to 1.5 cents. We're also very happy at the diversification that the legislature gave us with general fund dollars. They hadn't received general fund dollars, but when the fund was swept a couple of years ago, they needed it. And so now some of the funding, because all of the work that SPAR does, it's not just hydrocarbon related. There's PFAS. There's arsenic. There's other kinds of contaminants that aren't related to the oil and gas industry. And so bringing that general fund diversification has really helped SPAR and given it a breath of, you know, security that they needed, that I know a lot of the RCACs and other organizations that really focus on the work that SPAR does have brought them a lot of comfort.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please continue. Senator Kawasaki, he's got a small question.
It is small. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since you brought up the statehood defense and lawsuits and litigations potentially on some of the federal side, I did have a question about the federal SIP, if there was any talk or discussions about that.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, yes. We are watching very closely. It's not ripe yet in order to sue on the SIP. There's a public comment period that's going on right now. The regional administrator is going to be coming up to Fairbanks in early March. We hope the people of Fairbanks and North Pole come out and tell them that we think the state's SIP is good. But at that point, those comments will be able to be considered by the EPA, and then later this year they will finalize it. At that point, it will be ripe for potential litigation, and we will consider it at that point. Also, we're looking at the EPA's responsibility for certifying wood stoves. They've dropped the ball. They have not certified wood stoves like they are required to do, so we're looking at potential opportunities there as well.
Terrific. Thank you.
Senator Klayman.
Going back to the question that Senator Dunbar had, just to make sure I'm tracking, 4 cents comes from oil product or from pipeline, and then the other 0.95 cents comes from refined fuels, and so they're collected from different entities.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Klayman, it's 5 cents, 4 plus 1 from every barrel of oil that's produced in the state, both Cook Inlet and on the North Slope. 4 cents goes to the prevention account, 1 cent goes to the response fund, and then you're correct, 0.95 cents per gallon of refined fuel surcharge. So when you fill up your tank and you put 10 gallons in, 9.5 cents of that goes toward the funding of SPAR.
And follow up on that. And are you supporting an increase of that 0.95 cents to 1.5 cents?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, we are on the record last year, the year before, and this year supporting the increase from 0.95 cents to 1.5 cents.
And no change in the tax of what comes through the pipeline?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, that is correct. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
And water, and I know Randy and his team will be speaking to that later. as well as the infrastructure funding and project implementation, and to call out to that in the interest of brevity.
Yep.
I think we talked to that. But as a talking through kind of what Alaskans get for their money, we thought this was an interesting and kind of meaningful note that just 38 cents a day for protecting human health and the environment. And then to touch on, I think we've talked about federal dollars throughout this presentation, but just wanted to give you this visual as to less than 1% of the state's total UGF, but looking at kind of the large increase in EJA dollars that are denoted at the top of those visuals.
Any further questions? Okay, we're getting close.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's the departmental overview. Now we're excited to be able to provide a discussion of the 404 assumption efforts.
Correct. Okay. So now, Ms. Kohler, thank you for your presentation. Commissioner, are you gonna bring another chair up and you're going to stay at the table? That's correct. And Shannon Miller. The floor is yours, Commissioner. Take it away.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jason Bruni, Commissioner of DEC. I'm excited to have with me Julie Pack and Shannon Miller. We're going to talk about the feasibility study that the legislature generously funded us $1 million to conduct this past year to talk about the state's efforts to assume the Section 404 dredge and fill. So when we talk about what DEC does, you have to go back, obviously, to what Congress does. The Congress passed back in the late 60s and early 70s all sorts of environmental laws because there were all sorts of nasty things that were going on. So you had the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency. Soon thereafter, 51 years ago, you had the formation of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Each of you that were legislators last year should have gotten the honor coin that had celebrating 50 years of DEC. The Clean Air Act, obviously, these programs that are in place, we have something called cooperative federalism. Federalism, obviously, allows states to be able to oversee programs that Congress passes. So the Clean Air Act was passed, and the state made the decision that we have the expertise about our air. We understand the sometimes you can mow your lawn at midnight, and sometimes you have to be using your snowblower at midnight. There's different things that people in Seattle or Washington, D.C. just don't understand about Alaska. They don't understand our indigenous cultures, our emphasis on environmental protection and the environmental ethic that we have, our focus on subsistence, so many things that D.C. and Seattle just don't get. So having these programs overseen by Alaskans is so important. So we got primacy of the Clean Air Act back in the 70s when we first started as an organization. Soon thereafter, we took primacy over the Safe Drinking Water Act. Safe Drinking Water Act in the mid-70s, any entity, any community with 25 people that are served or more has to make sure, we have to make sure that their water is safe for the people to drink. So we got primacy of that in the 70s. In the mid-2000s, the legislature instructed us to assume primacy of the NPDES program, the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. And that is what they call to as Section 402 of the Clean Water Act. So that's when a local community discharges wastewater, or a fish processing discharges wastewater, or a mine or oil and gas. That is now overseen by the Department of Environmental Conservation. That was a four-year transition period. And so we got that program, and we fully assumed it, and we're up and running in 2012. This past year, the legislature gave us funding to become the 49th state to oversee the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act handling of hazardous waste. It funded us for 6 positions. As we talked about earlier, we're in the process of putting that application forward, and in hopefully July 1st of 2024, we will have that program fully under State of Alaska oversight. And what's up next? Obviously, the Clean Water Act Section 404. Back in 2013, you'll hear Shannon and Julie talk about this. You all passed legislation that instructed us to go forward with
with this effort. It was the specific language of SB 27 in 2013 stated, the Department of Environmental Conservation shall take reasonable steps to assume primacy of the 404 program. Again, we do no more and no less than what you instruct us to do. At the time, obviously, you instructed us to pursue this. When Governor Dunleavy came into office and he said, if there was one thing, Jason, we could do to improve the investment climate in the state, what would it be? And I said, we need to follow what the legislature instructed us to do. Let's take reasonable steps to assume the primacy of 404. And so this bill passed 15-2 in the Senate and 25-13 in the House, had bipartisan support. So we were excited, obviously, to recommence that effort. And again, with the legislature's funding of $1 million this past year to do this feasibility study, I think we got some great results that we're excited to pass on to you today. From a legal perspective, I'm now going to turn it over to Julie Pack with the Department of Law to talk about the legal components of it.
Question. Senator Klayman, please proceed.
Your slide references the 2013 legislation and taking reasonable steps. Are you saying that in 2013, after that legislation passed, that the department didn't take reasonable steps when they did an investigation and decided not to proceed further?
Yeah, Senator Klayman, through the chair, thanks so much. It's a perfect question, and I should have addressed that. I apologize. So the department was making reasonable steps, and unfortunately, oil prices fell. And this was an easy program to cut because there wasn't the money to be able to do it, and we hadn't started the program yet. So the program wasn't reengaged until this past year when the legislature generously funded us with $1 million to recommence looking at, is this something we truly want to do? And with the work that was done, we agreed that that's the approach that we believe we should be taking.
Senator Willicke, follow-up.
Did they prepare any reports or do any studies in the 2013 era, like similar to the report that we're looking at today from Jay North? Was there a similar report prepared in 2013?
Yes, Senator Klayman, through the chair, there absolutely was, and we submitted that on the record last year for legislature to see. I'd be happy to provide you with a copy of that again if you're interested in seeing that.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Willikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if money was the problem in 2013 and the Parnell administration pulled back because we had a several hundred million, maybe $1 billion deficit, we don't have a balanced budget this year. We have $500 to $800 million deficit this year. We still have a money problem. Am I wrong? Has the budget been balanced somehow that I'm not aware of?
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, the legislature holds the power of the purse. So I will tell you that this is a drop in the bucket. $5 million and $4.9 million, and eventually it'll be $4.7 million, is an investment for us to pursue this program that's well worth making. And in the long run, we're pursuing a couple of opportunities to diversify the funding. First and foremost, we have support from the Alaska Home Builders Association, the Associated General Contractors, the Miners Association, the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, the State Chamber of Commerce. There is interest from the regulated community in helping fund this through user fees. All of those programs that I showed you before that are primacy programs have some sort of fees that help supplement the funding, not just from a general fund perspective. Secondarily, every one of those primacy programs that I showed you on the previous slide as well get funding from the federal government. The 404 program is the only program that does not get funding from the federal government for states that want to assume it. The states of Florida, New Jersey, and Michigan, combined with other states that are looking at this, at potentially getting the assumption of this program, all believe that the federal government should be contributing something to this. We have put resolutions forward with the Environmental Council of States to try to get funding for this. We've talked to Senator Murkowski, Senator Sullivan, and they are interested in helping us get funding for this. So, yes, Senator Willikowski, there are budgetary issues right now, but this is a two-year investment that which will ultimately, hopefully, be funded both by the federal government, by the users that are getting these permits, as well as potentially general fund as well.
Follow up?
Yeah. And I mean, this will be taken up in the Finance Committee, but from my perspective, the fundamental concern with this has always been the money. And when you look at how many staff EPA has at the federal level to administer this program, we're nowhere near. And I know what you're going to say, it's we're only doing 75% of it. But if you look at those other states, and the information that I have is that in Michigan, for example, Michigan, New Jersey, Florida, they don't have anywhere near the amount of wetlands that we have. Michigan has 6.5 million acres of wetlands. They have 82 staff in 10 offices. New Jersey has 915,000 acres. They have 176 staff. Florida has 10 million acres. They had 170 staff. They just raised it to 212 staff. And they're saying in this year's budget, they have to add another 33 staff. So I think that's the fundamental problem with this program. And that's why we've seen that despite overwhelming support in the legislature, it's just too expensive. And it's a black hole for something that the federal government has funded for decades. And that even if the state assumes it, we still have to follow the federal regulations. So it's just my perspective is I know we're going to get into the numbers, but the numbers just have never penciled out, and I'm not sure that they do at this point.
Yeah, Senator Wilikowski through the chair. Thanks. That's fantastic points, and I think there's a couple of things that Shannon's going to be talking about in a little bit, but I want to address them very quickly. First and foremost, we do have 175 million acres of wetlands in the state. Nearly twice what the lower 48 has. We've only developed 0.1% of them, and I'm damn proud of that. That having been said, the reason why those other states need more positions is because they have a lot more economic and activity happening in them. You see a state like Florida, the number of home development projects they've had in the last couple of years has just gone through the roof with COVID. Everyone wants to live in Florida, but they're building on wetlands, and they need more staff for that. The number of positions that we have put forward are based on the number of activities they're going to have to do, not based on the amount of wetlands that they have. In addition, as you're worried about the black hole of money that might have to be spent on this, if we do have additional economic activity, guess what? That's going to lead to more royalties to the state, to more taxes to the state. It'll pay for itself. Industry wants this. In addition, the environmental community wants this because the compensatory mitigation that we're going to be able to do is actually going to have a benefit to the watershed where this development is occurring instead of a black hole that the money will be thrown into for a mitigation bank that we don't even know where that money is being spent. There's win-wins, Senator, and I look forward to working with you collaboratively to try to get us there.
Well, do you have a follow-up, Senator?
I appreciate that, and I guess my response would be let's hope, but instead of hoping, would you be willing to put a provision in the budget that said it's got to be cost neutral? No GF funds. It's got to be funded by industry since we're going to make all this money from it. Let's just make it cost neutral. Would you be willing to accept a provision like that?
Yeah, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I have made a commitment on the record last year and this year that we will work with the regulated community to talk about a fee structure that will have them have skin in the game. Right now, it's our responsibility to bring this application forward to the EPA and the Corps of Engineers and then have that discussion with the regulated community. You look at the other primacy programs that we have in the state and the discussion that ensued when NPDES was discussed, absolutely, industry came to the table and said, we want to put some of our skin in the game. Whether or not it's cost neutral or not, Senator Wilikowski, I'm not willing to make that commitment, but I know that if you were to ask them directly, they are willing to pay for some, if not all of the program, but that's going to be a discussion we're going to have in the open daylight, fully transparent, and we don't want to have impacts on the small mom and pops. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we're making it fair for all of the folks that are going to be benefiting from the state having assumption of this program.
Senator Klayman.
Just in terms of that big picture, I just want to articulate one of the places where I'm most troubled by this proposal is how many states have actually looked at this and not gone forward. There are 47 states, of which we are one, that have taken on the 402 program, and only 3 states have declined, and the District of Columbia has declined. So, and it's exactly the reverse on the 404. You have 47 states that could apply for and have either investigated and not done it, or have started down the process and said, oh, this is a bad idea. And so we're in this group of 47 states that looked at the cost and the complicated reality of taking this on. And they've all said no. I mean, and actually the Jay North report, they're just plain wrong. I'm a little troubled. They cite three states or four states that are that have looked at transition. There's, I count 23 states.
Senator,
that have specifically looked at this issue and specifically said, primarily for cost and complexity reasons, said not a good path to go down. It's the black hole that Senator Wilkowski is talking about.
Senator Clements,
and I just wanted to say that I'm very skeptical when you see that many states declining to go forward, and there's zero federal funding to support this if we take it over.
Sorry, Senator Clement, through the chair, I appreciate those comments. I think many of those states that have looked at it have probably already developed all of their wetlands. You look at California, they've developed 90-some percent of their wetlands. Why would they want to have that program? You know, we have 175 million acres. No one has more interest in making sure we protect and, where appropriate, develop and mitigate the impacts to those wetlands than Alaska does. No one should want this program more than we do. What the other states chose to do just because they got away with developing their wetlands in the past, that's not theirs. That's not for me to care about. I care about Alaska. I care about protecting our ecological benefits of our wetlands, but also allowing economic opportunities to occur with the expertise of Alaskans, not the expertise of someone who doesn't live in our state and doesn't care about our state.
And
by the way, Mr. Chair, Julie, I'd love for her to be able to present an answer to that question as well. She has some details in her presentation. I know we're short on time, so I'd love for the two of them to be able to provide the opportunity to talk about.
Well, we're just going to let it go, and the conversation go where it's going to go. And I'm not saying that flippantly, because if we run out of time, we're going to come back and pick up where we left off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Because there is nobody going to be rushed on this conversation, but we are going to quit at 5 o'clock.
I did have a follow-up to this.
Follow-up.
Just note, it's really easy to look at California, which has a whole host of more complicated environmental issues than we do because of the extent of development. I'm more interested in states like Wyoming, Montana, Minnesota, North Dakota, Kentucky, a bunch of states that I don't think of as blue states first off, but also places that have a lot of resource development going on. And they all have chosen not to go forward. And so, I mean, it's nice when you reference California, but let's look at states that do have wetlands, that do have undeveloped areas, and they're not taking the program on.
Mr. Chair, through the chair, Senator Clayman, the state with the second most amount of wetlands, Florida, just took on the program. Two blue states, New Jersey and Michigan, have had the program. We've talked extensively with them. So this isn't a blue state issue. This isn't a red state issue. This is a doing what's right for the wetlands and trying to partner with the development community to make sure projects can go forward, but at the same time you can protect the value of your wetlands in perpetuity.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate that we'll have a little bit more opportunity. But I did have just one comment to make on Senator Wilkowski's point that you know, we have a $500 million structural deficit this next fiscal year. We also have, I think, $19 billion in statutory budget reserve and constitutional budget reserve savings in 2013. And we still decided at that point not to pursue it. I guess my question, though, has more to do with this. It's that I want to make sure that if we do pursue it, and we do enlarge the DEC, that we can actually fill those positions, because we heard earlier that we've had sort of a lot of turnover. I think it was mentioned by the Admin Service Director that there's a huge loss of institutional knowledge within some of the agencies and some of the divisions. And so I want to know that it could be done in a safe manner. I think that's my biggest concern, is that the permits are done properly, on time for industry, and that there is some protections that are in place.
Yeah, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, thank you for those comments. God bless you. I will say that I want to be very clear. We are making probably some of the best progress amongst any state agency with respect to retaining employees and to promoting employees. We're a role model, in my opinion, and we're excited. We have cut our turnover rate in half in 4 years. That's something that's going to help us to be able to fill these positions necessary for bringing on a new program like this. When we had the RCRA program, we filled those positions just like that. All of those positions were filled with a lot of good people left on the table. So I have no doubt that we'll be able to, if necessary, bring some of the core folks on to work with us. But we want that Alaska expertise to be able to help us fill these positions, and I think we're going to be able to do it.
Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I cheated a little bit and looked right ahead in your presentation. So I have some questions for later on in the presentation, but we're still on this initial sort of phase. And I appreciate, Mr. Chair, you saying that we might have opportunity at a future hearing, because I do think this is going to go over. First is, because I don't think you mentioned in here, you know, there has been this push to have this be federally funded. Why not wait until it's federally funded? The other programs that people have adopted were already federally funded. Why not wait until we know that there's a funding source? That's one. And two, talking about the three states that have done it. So Florida did it in a sort of compressed two-year time frame. But I think that New Jersey and Michigan took significantly longer, 7 years or more. And so what allowed Florida to do it that quickly? And do we think that the sort of regulatory environment right now, our relationship with EPA, will allow us to do it in 2 years, because I think you mentioned 2 years earlier in your presentation, allow it to do it in 2 years, or more realistically take that full 7 years with the other states took?
Yeah, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, thanks so much. What a great question. And I think we're so excited because the state of Florida has just gone through all of this. A lot of this is fresh on the minds of the EPA and the Corps of Engineers. A lot of the biops with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service, a lot of the discussion of the issues, talking with the Corps about what's assumable areas, what are retained areas, that is fresh in the minds. Whereas 20, 30 years ago when New Jersey and Michigan did it, those people have probably long since retired. So that's why I think we're going to be able to do this more expeditiously than they did. I'm actually quite confident that with respect to our relationship with the Corps and the EPA, they've been nothing short of fabulous. These programs are designed by Congress to be assumed by states. They're supposed to be. They recognize states have more expertise than we'll ever have in Region 10 in Seattle or in Washington, D.C. They're designed to be assumed, so they've actually given us funding. We got $49,000 from the EPA to be able to do wetlands delineation and look at a wetlands program for the state. They've met with us multiple times. They've convened folks from around the nation to help us. Hey, this is what we want, what you guys should be doing, what you need to be looking at. We've met with them. We've had meetings with the Corps of Engineers. They gave us all the information that we used to develop the feasibility study. I mean, so they've been nothing short of fantastic in this partnership that we have because they recognize through cooperative federalism, we're always going to have to work together. And remember, this program that we put as a state has to be as strict or stricter than the federal government's. We can't cut any corners. We're going to be able to protect our wetlands way better than anyone in Washington State or D.C. will be able to do. And so they recognize that. They want our expertise, and they've been, like I said, nothing short of fantastic as partners in helping us assume this program.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a brief follow-up. My first question, I'm sorry, it was a two-part question. There's two separate questions, so I apologize. My first question was, you know, you point out this is bipartisan, red state, blue state, lots of people, including Senator Murkowski, pushing to get it funded. So why not, it seems like we're kind of putting the cart before the horse. Why not wait for the funding source before we do this? Why not wait for the federal government to start funding this?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I can only go with what I know, and we think this is a good investment of state dollars to pursue right now. And concurrently, we're pursuing an effort to get it at the federal level. That having been said, the federal government won't fund it anyway until you actually have your application blessed. So at a minimum, that's going to be 2 years. And in that time frame, I promise you, we'll be working to get that federal funding so that we'll help diversify those funding sources.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Are we ready for the ladies to start?
Yeah, we absolutely are. And I think the final thing to point out is we have a choice to either control our own destiny or let the federal government control our destiny. I know what I want. I want Alaskans overseeing permitting. I want Alaskans overseeing the ecological values of our wetlands, and I want us taking care of the economic opportunities and environmental protections. I want us control of our own destiny. With that, I'm going to turn it to Julie Pack, who is going to talk about the legal aspects.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, members of the chair. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of you all today. I'm going to go through the legal landscape of Section 404 in the Clean Water Act. But before that, I wanted to touch on something that's come up quite a bit recently, and that's the Department of Law's stance on how EPA's 404 veto power intersects with the 404 assumption program were a state to assume the program. And the department's position is that EPA statutory 404C power will be unaffected by state assumption of the 404 program. So just
a question about that. We got three lawyers on this committee in case you haven't done your homework. Senator Klayman.
When you talk about the veto power, are you saying that specifically if the state gets through this assumption process, whether it's 2 years or 7 years, and assumes 404 permitting authority, even if the state takes assumption over certain amount of waters and wetlands, the EPA would still have veto authority over any decision made by the state as to its portion of the 404 program?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, thank you for the question. I first have to preface this with no court has ruled on the specific question. We have three states, as you have pointed out, that have assumed this program, and EPA has only exercised this power to finalize this power 14 times now as of the most recent determination. So because of those very few instances in both the 404 assumption context and the veto context, a court has never opined on the question you ask, which is how do those intersect? And so we're acting in this technical legal gray area. Now, what I can tell you is what the federal statutes say and what the regulations say. The federal statutes under Section 404J provide for a federalization process. What that process is EPA, when they receive a copy of a permit application, and under the statutes, the state is required to give a copy of each permit application to EPA. EPA at that point has the opportunity to raise objections. The state must resolve those objections. If the state does not resolve those objections, then EPA can what's called federalize the permit, which means take it away from the state and give it back to the Corps. Once that permit is back on that federal track, EPA's 404C power applies just as it did for Bristol Bay.
Follow up.
So in the instance the state comes up, state has a permit, it starts the process, and the feds look and have objections. They're not satisfied with the state response, and then the state or the federal government federalizes that particular permit, which means takes it away from the state, right?
Correct, and gives it back to the Corps.
Now, when you mentioned in the three states there's been 14 instances that have occurred over time, is that 14 times when the federal government, the Corps, has essentially federalized a state permit in one of those three states, or are those something else, the 14 instances you talk about?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, those 13 instances that I spoke about were EPA's previous exercises of its 404C power. That is independent of the three states that have assumed, and none of EPA's 13 vetoes have been over state permits issued by a state-assumed program. So I apologize for my lack of clarity. I was trying to illustrate that there's a lot of daylight between those two concepts.
And then further follow-up.
Further follow-up.
As to the three states that have taken on 404 authority, has the EPA either vetoed or rejected, or I mean any list of words, but has the EPA taken any action to disapprove in some manner or form of a state permit that was issued by that state permitting authority?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, yes, EPA has federalized one Florida permit, and EPA has federalized at least one, and I don't want to I want to defer to Shannon on the numbers, but EPA has federalized at least one other permit in either Michigan or New Jersey. I cannot recall which state at this point. So EPA has used that federalization power under 404J to give a permit back to the Corps.
And that's what we're talking about as a veto.
Those are two separate concepts. The 404C is commonly referred to the veto power. The 404J is kind of like an equivalent. It has been compared to 404C, but it's under another subsection, and it applies to state permits specifically.
Follow-up?
This is your last follow-up.
Explain how the veto then works different. I mean, you talked about federalizing a permit, which is under 404J. Mm-hmm. So where does the 404C come into play?
And I don't get another question, so you better be good on the answer.
Through the chair, Senator, 404C has not come into play in any of the three state assumed programs that we have in the United States.
We'll give you another crack at the apple, but we're going to go around the table since we've got some more questions. Senator Wilikowski.
Correct me if I'm wrong. 404C was the provision by which the EPA effectively vetoed the Pebble Mine.
That, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that's correct.
And we heard from the Commissioner of DNR several days ago that the administration was contemplating a lawsuit to challenge that authority. Are you aware of that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that's correct, and I am aware of it.
Has the administration made a decision to go forward in that lawsuit?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the administration has issued a press release indicating Attorney General Taylor has indicated that we are discussing a lawsuit and we are preparing to bring a lawsuit. Yes.
Please continue.
Last one, just a comment. It just seems a little odd that you would sort of tout that this EPA still has this veto power, which you are preparing a lawsuit to overturn. Would you agree? Doesn't that seem a little odd?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, as you frame it, if that were the extent of the story, I would agree that's odd, but there's a lot more to the story, and specifically how EPA used the language under 404C to do what it did and to do what it has never done before in any other state in any of the previous 13 vetoes. There are other reasons, independent of what are at play here, that the Department of Law is challenging that.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar, and then we're going to go to Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said something interesting there about federalizing, that the EPA federalized one Florida permit, but Florida just assumed this power, so that was pretty quick. Could you speak a little bit more about that case, and is that generating a lawsuit from Florida? Is Florida attempting to sue? Is there any legal controversy about that federalization from Florida's perspective?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, thank you for the question. That federalization was specifically related to a dispute over the definition of waters of the United States and how that applied. If you recall, the Trump administration issued the NWPR rule, which was a different definition of WOTUS than the Biden administration is now implementing. And if you'll recall, too, the Trump rule got vacated in August of 2021. And so that specific federalization of that permit was because of a dispute over the definition of waters of the United States. And there has been no legal lawsuit or legal consequences that have impacted the state of Florida as a result of that. The permit was federalized, and then no one sued Florida.
No, I guess what I was wondering, Florida sued the federal government, but it sounds like they did not.
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, that's correct. Florida has not sued the federal government over that.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair, if I could. Could you might not know this off the top of your head, but what kind of project was it that led to the federalization? Was it, you said the home builder, for example, was it like a small residential, or are we talking about a relatively large project that led to this federalization?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I don't have those details at the tips of my fingertips, and I would prefer, if it's okay, to get back to you with something written. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, so my turn. I just want to get a quick one in here, and it's great questions. So, Commissioner, if this program hypothetically was approved, in my experience with having primacy, workplace safety and health, you had to go through an annual review to keep your primacy. Is that would be the case for this program too? So would you go through an annual EPA audit to keep this program?
So, Chair Bishop, I think the perfect person to answer that would be Shannon.
Through the chair, for the record, Shannon Miller, Program Manager, Division of Water with the Department of Environmental Conservation. So the answer to that question is, it depends. We are currently working with EPA. And the reason why I say it in such a way is, our typical process is to work with EPA on a regular basis. So we don't have the annual review with some of our water programs as maybe other primacy programs do. Instead, what we have is a regular conversation with them. And when we need to make corrections, we make those corrections. And I anticipate that it would be very similar. So before it goes through the level of before it reaches a point of an annual review type of process, the discussion is being had regularly, so it gets corrected at the time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I please add to that statement that Program Manager Miller made? The statutes do require a report be submitted by the state to EPA annually, if that helps inform the discussion.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I'll also add that all of our other primacy programs have what's called the SRF, the State Review Framework, that is like a every five-year report card that comes from the mothership, from the EPA. And if you recall, 3 years ago, they came to us and said, you're not doing sufficient inspections for the 404 program. So I came to you and I requested additional positions so that we could do additional inspections. That's that type of ongoing relationship that Shannon talked about on a daily basis, combined with the required reporting that we have to do. We work collaboratively to protect human health and the environment, and we'll continue to do that.
Another question. Help me. Out of the 100, because we're getting close to the witching hour, we got a little bit more time to go here, but of the 175 million acres, is it all state land? Or is it, what's the mix?
Chair Bishop, it's all over the state. It's ANCSA lands, it's state lands, it's federal lands, that so it's all 40, over.
43% state lands? What's the percentage of state lands that belongs to the state of Alaska of the wetlands?
Senator Bishop, that is something that we will get back to you. I don't know what percentage of state lands are wetlands.
So I want to go, because here, so bear with me. So we had talked in this committee and in finance over the years at table with DNR's budget to look at taking over to try to on this compensatory mitigation, right? Because states are running out of land, right? And we're going to start talking carbon here next week. So you tracking with me? So I'm looking at other revenues. I mean, is there, would this program allow us to let other states maybe buy into some of our wetlands? That's, you know, we've got wetlands we'll never develop for anything. And we were trying to set up a compensatory mitigation program within DNR some time back.
Yes, Chair Bishop, I think I can't completely answer that question, but I know that when you're talking about mitigating impacts to wetland destruction, you generally want to have that in the same watershed. So if the state of California is going to have an impact to wetlands, probably in an ideal world, they would create new wetlands within the state of California. Whether or not what we're doing with the carbon projects could be done to mitigate the impacts, I can't answer that question, but I think that there's a lot of opportunity that Governor Dunleavy and Commissioner Boyle see at the state being able to realize revenue through carbon projects, either through carbon sequestration or through carbon offset projects. I talked about that during my confirmation process 4 years ago. I think there's huge opportunities here, but I don't know if it's necessarily tied into the 404 assumption program.
I just throw it out there as I don't know, not as an answer today, but just whet your appetite on looking at other revenue streams with this program to help offset in case, you know, maybe the bill does pass, right? And to supplant, sometimes that's a bad word, but to plant GF and look at other, you know, DGF funds or receipt supported funds, or pick your topic, but anything but GF, right? But the last thing I'd like to say is, the last time I spoke, and if Frank Ridgers is listening from AGDC today, I think the bill for the wetland mitigation offset for AKLNG was getting north of around $800 million. So that's another reason I bring up mitigation. That's a huge cost. If you could lower that, it might help your project economics. So, all right, it's 5 o'clock. We're at quitting time. And I just would like to say that the coach and I will get together and we'll get you rescheduled because we want to hear from the ladies here next. We like listening to you, but yeah. Well, thank you all, and let me just make sure that I have not missed anything. Announcements: Wednesday, February 15th, we're going to have our second hearing on SB 33, the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, and I will pass the gavel to my other co-chair, Senator Giesel, and we're going to have an overview of statehood defense. So we are adjourned at 5:01.